Welcome to the Level Design Podcast, where we look at the world of game development through the lens of level design. In this episode, we answer your questions from the panel at EGX 2019. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. So we had a whole panel at EGX, quite exciting, main room, lots of people, lots of very bright lights, with John McKellen answering everyone's questions. It went very well, but it was so short, wasn't it?
Yeah, it went over way too quickly.
Yeah. So with me today is most of the original panel is Claire. Say hello, Claire, so everyone knows.
Oh, hello. Hiya.
There's Jonathan.
Hey, Wilson.
And joining us this time, who couldn't make EGX, is Rob McLachlan.
Hello.
Yay! So I'm trying to give you some of the vibes we had at EGX. It was good times. It was very exciting because that's where this podcast comes from RESD. For our new listeners, we did a panel at RESD and I thought, well, why don't we do a podcast? And EGX invited us back to the main event at London's Excel. And we managed to fill out a rather big room, which was kind of a little bit gut-wrenching, you know, because 5 minutes before we were due to talk, the room was empty. I've got photographs of an empty room.
Yeah, the before and after shots were quite intimidating.
Yeah, and it's all on video. We're going to put the link in the description of the podcast so you can go and watch that. And in that panel, we got to ask everyone to send us some questions so that we could answer them. And we got loads. And we did promise we'd come back to them. So here we are, coming back to your questions from EGX. So what are we going to talk about today? How about we start with Mike B's question? How do you present completed levels on a website portfolio? Are finished white boxes okay? I mean, I'm going to just say one thing. Just use ArtStation. Don't use some crazy homemade, homespun portfolio for showing your work. Just straight off the bat. Don't know if you've had this experience. Anybody else has had this experience. You get some crazy Wix site.
I think it depends. Like, I agree. The simplicity of it is good. But I think ArtStation, you see that and you still think you're getting an environment artist or a 3D artist sending you something. If you are doing a level designer, I wouldn't expect to see anything flashy, but right, like just some kind of pre-built, like almost template. It's more about the work you're putting on there than the right kind of like asset you're using. But like in terms of the question, I would say yes, white boxes are fine, because I've seen level design portfolios where they're showing me like finished art levels and I'm like, well, you're not really showing me your design process here. You're not showing me what this looked like, how it read when it was a white box. If you want to do full art levels, you may want to look into whether it's level design or environment art you're actually looking to go down as well. I'd be more inclined to see white boxes in a level designer's portfolio than a fully arted environment.
Yeah, it's the whole YouTube speed level design horror played out in miniature. What I really want to see when I look at level designer's portfolio, like Jonathan just said, is I want to see the design process. I want to see your thoughts and how you got to where you completed a level. And when I say completed a level, I think a white box is absolutely fine. In fact, I prefer to see a white box because there's nowhere to hide in a white box. You can't hide behind some fancy bit of art. You can just show this is exactly how the level flows. This is how the player goes through the level. This is what the player's feeling. This is what the player sees at each point of the level. And I think the advantage of a site like ArtStation is you can show nice big pictures of the level, but you also need to be able to talk about those pictures. So you probably ought to get your favorite image editing program out and put some text on your pictures and say, this is what's happening, because that's really, really crucial.
Probably even your sketches that you did along the way, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just to, you know, if you're including annotations, then you might as well show your entire process.
Absolutely. Like that.
Yeah. It's not uncommon to be able to digitize those sketches now either. Like layout, you can use Photoshop, you can use Pixlr, which is like free online stuff. It's like, and it, all it is a quick and easy thought process of you plotting out the space. And then your blockout logically leads on to that, usually, because it'll follow it to some degree. But it also shows your iteration process as well, right? You can see what you had on paper, and we can see the blockout at the end.
Yeah. I love seeing sketches done on paper and scanned into a website, because it means that you're not ashamed to show something that might be a little bit crap and scrappy. Because then you'll be the sort of person who, when they come into the studio, they'll get up on a whiteboard and they'll draw something and they won't go, I'm too scared, I'm too rubbish, I won't show anything. It's a really, really good sign.
There's some great videos by Naughty Dog that they were showing Uncharted blockouts, right? And just a whole, you know, the sizes of things. And, you know, there's a bit of that. Well, there is actually quite a lot of action that you can see how he's climbing things. And it's really obvious. It's just a white box. It's not hidden by, oh, this is a mountain and this is a ravine or this is a swingy thing. It's like all very, the mechanics are in there and you're showing how your level design, or they're showing how their level design fits in with their mechanics, which is what I think everyone would want to see, right? Following on from what you were saying, Jonathan, the other thing you could do is I know this is pretty much cutting it down as a niche, but if on Procreate and many other programs, you know, when you draw something, you can show create it as a video of your sketch.
And it pieces it together.
Yeah, it pieces it together. So maybe you could, you know, overdraw over your photographed, you know, scrappy bit of paper, because what I found with sketches make sense to me, but there is an axis of time in them. Does that make sense? It's like, oh, you're going to walk around this way and I've just drawn a line that now makes no sense because it's just a line unless I put little arrows or something like that. But
I think that's why, like you said, paper for some people it does help, like, to rough it out. But if you were to try something like SketchUp all the out, like, you can do that line, but you can erase it immediately because it's digital. Same if you were doing it in Photoshop or anything. But sometimes it's good to do that course correction and have that really, like Rob kind of suggested, that kind of messy sketch, because it shows your process, like your thought process and how you got to it before you even started, which is sometimes interesting to see.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I've could be good, maybe not for every single level you've made, would be to show yourself playing it, to record a video yourself playing it, talk over it and say, this is all wrong. You know, this is what happens here. This is what the player's seeing. This is what the player's feeling. This is what the player's planning. You don't even have to talk over it if you think you have a terrible voice. You could even just write on it and write on the video and say, this is what the player sees here, sees there. And that can be really helpful.
Because that's kind of what you'd do with the rest of the team anyway, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, certainly. And it's a really good design exercise, because when you start playing it yourself and you start walking through it, you will find yourself going, and then, oh dear, and you'll suddenly realize that you've made a big error with your block out and actually it doesn't work, so you can then go back and fix it, because sort of that sort of rubber ducking thing of talking to and even to yourself and just going, oh yeah, whoops, I've actually made a problem there.
There is always the point, though, when, like, yes, you can test it and pick out flaws in it initially or problems in it, but eventually you do grow a sense of, like, almost blindness to it. Like, so you have to put it into the hands of somebody who doesn't know, because eventually you're just like, yeah, it's fine. You made this, right? You know where you're going. You're going from point A to point B. And sometimes the best little bit of feedback you'll ever get is drop it in someone else's hands and just watch them. It's always quite amusing.
Absolutely.
Well, somebody else to break your toy.
It's like, well, why are you doing that?
It's very good, difficult to not say anything though while someone's playing it, because, you know, the best way of doing it is just to let them do it and let them figure it out. But it's so hard if you're watching to be like, not say like, oh, you just need to go over here, or like, oh no, I'm sorry, that's not finished yet. But
I'd highly recommend, if you're going to do that approach, definitely do it with like colleagues or in the office first. Don't wait until like a trade show for it to be the first time you've let someone else play your level,
because
you can't be jumping on every person that comes up and say, no, you don't play it that way. You can't kind of do that. You've got to let them go. And it is a research gathering app for you as well. So,
yeah, so to go on a bit of a tangent of that, because but when I did go to EGX, I went on the Friday and I saw some of the students' games from the transducer groups from Abate and from the NFTS. Really, really good to play their games and to experience the things they'd created. One thing I did notice was, just like Jonathan was just referring to, and Claire said, you get these horrendous difficulty spikes. And some of the students who are showing me their games are saying, oh yeah, everyone's messed up there. And I'm thinking, well, before you take your game to a trade show, you know, get people to play through it. If they all fail at a certain point, then fix that really ideally, because otherwise you'll feel a little bit embarrassed if you're saying to every single person who comes up and play it, oh well, failed there, I messed up there. So yeah, just to go on a bit on that subject.
I mean, there's a whole testing sidetrack that we could go on. Like, one of them is goes to the web, but if it's games, the same. We used to do eye tracking software, so you used to get a video of what the person did with hotspots of where their eyes were tracking. So, I mean, this is not going to be for like the indie developer, right?
Yeah.
But if you have a couple of sessions or you do these recordings, that data can be invaluable, because then you really don't want to say anything, because you want to see where they're looking at and the things that they're picking up. But then again, that would be a bit later down the line, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
We're going back to how you present your work. One of the things that we've just had is Blocktober. So there's, if you follow the hashtag Blocktober, or look it up now, because there's still going to be thousands of posts, you can see other people's work and how they're presenting it and how they're showing. And the whole point of Blocktober is not to do any art.
I think the other important thing with that hashtag as well, especially if you're a student or even if you're like looking to break in, it's an excuse to build portfolio pieces, right? It's like, even if you're in the industry and you want to build something to put on a portfolio, because you could be under NDA and you can't show what you're working on, if you participate in that like month of Blocktober, or even if you just do one block out, there's a portfolio piece you can show now, and it's going to be used in the stuff you've learned on the job anyway of building levels for your active title. And it, like, as an upcoming level designer, it does start to build you this nice portfolio of work, and then you get to add to it when your ship title kind of comes out as well.
Yeah, I think it's important even just to get into that practice of putting something out there, because I think it's really easy when you're starting out to get into that mentality of like, oh, I can't show anything until it's finished. It needs to be at like a certain standard. Like, I know I had that, and I've heard that a lot from other people as well. So I think just being able to know that it's okay to put something up on the internet and for people to look at it is a really, it's a good skill to have, because you know, in development, you're constantly going to be making things that aren't finished.
It opens you up to like feedback and criticism, and that's something you're not ever really going to escape. It doesn't matter like what position you get in the industry, like your work's not going to be perfect. As matter how many levels you build, you're not going to like get it exactly right like that first time. It takes iteration. That's why game development takes time. It's like we're trying to second guess what a user or a player is going to do, and that's not the easiest thing to do until you've had some usability testing on a level.
Well, the cheaper way to do that usability testing is by doing it before you've got the whole art team and the environment artists and the narrative team to have to do the things, because then those changes, I mean, I've been experiencing this recently. We've been changing some of the story in the game that we're making, and it's like, for good, because we've been able to chop out whole areas. And I'm so glad we didn't do any art or anything like that, because it would have been heartbreaking to go, well, no, this is now all gone to the bin, or gone to that temp folder in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
I find it also hilarious that we have Blocktober and now we have Nodevember for the shader artists out there.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
No, nor did I.
I am deep in the Twitters, and yes, there's Nodevember.
Are people who make blueprints allowed to participate in Nodevember?
Nodevember could be anything, right? Anything that has a like visual graph-based system.
Well, I think so. I mean, I with Blocktober as well, it's just a hashtag, right? So I don't think there's a set of rules out there that you have to comply with or be thrown off the internet. Like Nodevember is like they show those node graphs and what they're achieving with them, and it's looking pretty cool.
You could post up your most disgusting behavior trees so never get triggered and anything. Wonderful.
Yeah. You can just see like all being triggered and looping and looping and looping and nothing's happening. It never comes out of that loop. Awesome. Well, hopefully that we've answered that question. That was from Mike B. The next question is from, I'm sorry if I butcher your surname, Charles Kucharazak. He asks, how do you choose between what the player should be able to figure out versus prompting giving hints? This kind of falls into the testing.
To a degree, like whether it works, what you put into your game will be identified through testing, but thinking about how you're going to do it kind of has to be done during the design phase. It's like, you know what the objective of your space is, you know what the player's going to have to do. I guess it's not just level design in this circumstance, because it comes into like the whole realm of game design as well, because you have mechanics which are your tools usually to build your levels, and they'll have their own language in general, so like how they function and operate will have like a visual hint or some distinction for them. It doesn't have to be a prompt or a UI prompt, but like it can be anything from what represents a jump pad or a gravity pad should be consistent throughout your level, so you're not breaking that. The general rule of thumb I think most people tend to follow is like, you only ever really want to show the player what to do. You don't necessarily want to explicitly tell them how to do it. If you've designed your game well enough, they'll understand how to use your game systems, and then the challenge is to use those systems to get to the destination.
It also depends where along the game you are at, if that makes sense. Like, you got tutorializing sections, and this is where you'd get a lot of hints. You know, like, you know, here's where you can plant a postbox or whatever. In later on, you'd get like hints, which are you seem to have walked past an area that you could do X action and you didn't. The game might go like, you know that you could do the thing over here. Yeah. You know,
it's a lot. I guess it's tracking the player's behavior as well to a degree. Like you said, you do have prompts at the beginning about tutorializing how to do an action or how to perform something, and they become less because the idea would be after so long through your game, the player has learned or understands or has made the association that's how this works. So you don't have to keep battering them over the head with the same prompts.
I mean, let's look at a like really, really, really simple action. In level design, right? Like climbing onto a ledge, just like, I don't know what's the term of this, you know, sprinting, not a step, but something that's bigger than a step.
A mantle?
Or a mantle, thank you.
A mantle or a vault, yeah.
Yeah, a mantle or a vault onto something, right? When you just start the game, it says, you know, you press X to vault. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine how annoying that would be, like 3/4 through the game going, oh, look, you've just found another thing. Did you know that you can press X, you know?
Yeah, what John was saying was right. It goes really, this question, to the heart of the dialogue that you're establishing between the player and the game and what kind of game you are. Because there are certain games where you just don't want to have anything on the screen. You don't have any prompts. And it might be that your mechanics are simple enough that you can get away with that. Yeah. You take a game like Dear Esther. You really don't want to have anything saying, look, ooh, press E to examine, press, you know, walk over here. It's just completely ruins the entire point of the game. You do have that kind of assumed knowledge of the player, you know, that they understand the language of games and that WASD probably move you, or, you know, moving the left stick moves you or something. But yeah, you have to decide quite early on in the game design what you are going to accept in terms of literally saying to the player, this is how to do this, and whether you're going to do it on the screen, kind of like right on the UI, or whether you're going to have someone in the game saying, now you have to go to door 3, go do this. Yeah, this is how you jump, try this, and all that kind of stuff, you know, right from the first examples of that when in the first Halo, when you have the technician who sort of wakes you up and says, oh, try looking at the lights, and then he works to have inverted controls from that, and that was everyone's going, wow, I can't believe this, I'm not just ticking a tick box. So yeah, you have to decide really early on in the game what kind of game it is and what tools are acceptable to use, because yeah, you can have a load of on-screen prompts and stuff if you really want, but I think most designers nowadays want to get away from that.
Yeah. I was playing The Last of Us recently just to look at the UI, because I didn't remember any UI in The Last of Us. And then I realized there's quite a lot of it, because there's a whole crafting thing and stuff like that. But I was looking at the in-game rather than inventory UI. I noticed that they subtled it out but I'd never remembered this being there. So it's a good UI. Do you know what I mean? It's it's good because you don't remember it's there, but it is actually there. It's a little ring that draws your attention to something when you're close enough to it.
Yeah. It's also done like with very few like inputs as well to it. Like they've minimized them down because you have a backpack with you, so you don't have this endless inventory where you can go around and around and around. You can like maybe you have different types of objects assigned to different parts of the backpack, so you can move like maybe left twice for like bricks and bottles or whatever to do distractions. Yeah. You've got small weapons, which I think would be like rice, and then you've got like bows and shotguns and rifles like on the up, but there was only ever I think like 2 button presses to get in and out of it, and you would have equipped something else. I think it's touched upon in the Grounded documentary they did a while ago. They talk about the button floor they did for the UI and a little bit about how long it took them to iterate to that point as well.
That's a really great documentary, actually, because I think they also do a little bit of the white boxing, if I remember right. I saw a couple of years ago.
Yeah, one of the other problems that designers will be wrestling with, and, you know, I think we'll always talk about this, that designers do angst over things and discuss things and argue about things interminably. You know, you might say, okay, we've got this wonderful tutorial, this wonderful onboarding, doesn't require any on-screen prompts or anything. People just naturally figure it out by wonderful, carefully graded exercises that the player does that slowly builds up skills and introduces new concepts. And then you go, wow, that's wonderful. And then your player goes away for 2 weeks, comes back to the game and can't remember anything to do.
Right.
There's no UI.
Yeah, that's true.
oh my God, I can't remember anything. So how do you get over that?
I've got to say, a certain game made about postmen carrying boxes in one of the many options has got like one of the tips are like, I think they get this out of their design document because it says like, if you want to do this, here's a whole list of stuff to do. And this is how you do that. And there's a lot of actions in that game, to be fair. No one knows what I'm talking about. I don't want to say the name for the moment. But there's one action that I had to do that I kind of read it and forgot it. And then it's actually quite important for you to do. And then realize that you had this whole list of stuff. And thank you. Thank you for just giving me like a nice cheat sheet.
Yeah, I guess it's important to like keep the balance of it and just be aware of how jarring the UI is, like, or how sort of like frustrating it's going to be for the player. It took me about before I forget, just when you pick up an item and look at it, I really was against having any UI in that for about 2.5 years. But then it got to the point where I think enough people were kind of like, oh, it's not intuitive enough that now we've just got like a small amount of UI that sort of tells you how to move the object. And it's just like quite unintrusive at the bottom. And hopefully playtesting will find that's enough. But I think it's just making sure that it doesn't like get in the way of gameplay. It's just there if you need it, but it doesn't stop you from playing.
Yeah, I think that the small hints for immediate interaction are fine when they are, one, stylistically the same. Like, for example, Before I Forget has got a kind of, there's a desaturated look to quite a lot of stuff. So if you suddenly put this like bright red, like arrows, it'll be like really jarring. Or a bright red, you can pick this up, you know, big flashy, you know, how in some games you have like gold shiny over the glittery over objects that you can pick up. That'd be really out of place in I'll put a link to the video Before I Forget. I don't think I've done it in a previous episode. So
it's surprising how obtrusive some of those implementations of the glowing things are in some old school games like the Thief series. And stuff you can interact with really, really glows.
It's the Scooby-Doo thing, you know. Do you know the Scooby-Doo thing that you know that they're going to go through that door that they've painted?
Because the cell is different, slightly different color to the background.
And I think I can't remember who was saying it. It's the guy that did Black Mirror. He was saying like, you know that you can't go through that door in games because it looks like built into the set and painted on compared to the actual doors that you can open, which are blueprints or whatever. They're actual like prefabs that are completely different.
Yeah, often in many game engines, the movable objects have a different render path to the static objects. You literally see the difference because, like, right, that door is obviously openable.
Awesome. Talking about sort of blueprints and static meshes, Jacob asks, how difficult is it to create procedural level design engines? Can they ever be truly good? Or is it frowned upon by level designers? I'll give you a shot of all of us frowning because we're frowning upon this.
I'll launch into say I don't feel too threatened by procedural level design. I don't feel it's like a kind of like, I don't feel like I need to throw things into the machines to stop them, to put me out of a job. I find it quite fascinating, and it's about coming up with rules to make them.
Yeah, I think that's the key point. Like procedural generation for anything, right? It gets brought up a lot, and it is good, but pure randomness doesn't, like, if you ever build a very simple procedural like algorithm or whatever to put together pieces of a level, it'll eventually end up with dead ends or whatever, stuff like that. And like Rob said, you need a level of curation and you need a rule set. And one of the biggest things you usually find is you'll have curation and waiting. So it's kind of like how often a tile can appear, like what types of tiles are they? And all this is usually decided upon with a designer in probably a spreadsheet going through and actually putting these waitings together. But then it takes a lot of testing because you cannot, unless you set a limit, you can't test every variant of this. So you need to go through and you need to rigorously test this as much as possible. But yeah, it needs some kind of curation. So I don't feel threatened. I do feel that if it became a thing, it like overall, it would change maybe the type of design we do as level designers, but we're probably still going to be the ones that have to construct the tiles. So choose what like exits they have, where they go. Is this a boss tile? Is it an encounter tile? Because the game's still going to need balance and balancing and things like that as well.
I think procedural level design depends how you're thinking about it. If you're thinking of like, you know, like maze designers or things like that, I see as always as a exercise in game engine development that I see in a lot of tutorials and things like that. But when you want to get to the next level, look at things like No Man's Sky, right? All of that is procedural, and that's really, really procedural. I mean, not level design, but game design, I guess, or world design. And they did a very good talk that can influence, I say they, Sean Murray from Hello Games did a really good talk in one of the GDCs, and it's on YouTube. I'm gonna have to find it and link it, about how they had to do that. And it's going way beyond Perlin noise, which everyone uses for random, a nice random pattern for generating stuff, to wayfinding. And in that same event, they also did a talk with one of the designers, and they said how they curated a lot of the patterns that were coming out, right? So it's, I think it's going to help. It's a tool set to help, not to replace a level designer.
Yeah, and I think that's a better way of looking at it as well.
Yeah, I guess it hugely depends on just like the type of game that you're making as well. There'll always be games that where procedural generation just doesn't make sense, and there's, you know, probably always going to be games where it does make sense. I guess like No Man's Sky is a good example, and things like Proteus and games like that, where the experience is dependent on your like individual experience of these things that you can't predict. But then if you want a highly predictable game, like a narrative game or something like that, then I don't know, maybe in the future there'll be some new genre of games where that makes sense. Or but yeah, I think it's just dependent, like you've all been saying. I don't think it's a threat, because it's just a different type of level design. It's just using it in the right way.
Yeah, I love the name drop of Proteus. That's a wonderful example. Yeah.
So lovely.
It's a very similar experience, but not quite the same experience, because things are jumbled up in a slightly different order. So yeah, you got wonderful sort of serendipity that some people found it a really emotional experience, that game. I'm going to name drop another game. It's a game called Rico by Ground Shatter, which has got fully procedural level design.
Is it RICO?
Yeah. And that's where you run through kicking doors and shooting people in the face.
It's like the SWAT sort of thing. Like
exactly, yeah. Something. Like really fast and procedurally designed, procedurally generated. And I really enjoy the game. There are still some problems that sometimes come up with things appearing in the middle of the rooms. I think they got some really good systems that always ensure the whole level is navigable and you can always get to it. It's about having a good enough procedural generation engine to make sure that you don't, and rules to make sure you don't end up with things that actually break the game. It's okay to have like, why is this toilet sitting in the middle of a dining room? But then when it starts being, I literally can't get up the stairs because there's,
a toilet in front of the stairs.
Exactly, yeah. Then you start getting into all sorts of difficulty.
I saw during Blocktober, there were some people started to use Houdini, because that's a procedural engine for VFX, but now it's being used a lot for procedural meshes, for example. So let's, as an example, I know this is not what comes to mind when you talk about procedural, but it's like cities with buildings in them. Like instead of it being the walled off rooms that you have in Grand Theft Auto 5, for example, you could have a whole city with buildings that you can go into, right? There might be nothing interesting in them, but all the buildings are generated, and that's all parameterized by Houdini interacting with the game engine. So I see like a massive use of that. So I wouldn't frown. Yeah.
Even for chunks of a level, that would work really well, wouldn't it? You could just put in a building, a small building or something. For a game like PUBG, that would be really
right.
Procedurally generated that map each time. That could probably make people really happy, and it would probably save them a lot of angst.
A lot of time.
The big buzzword at the moment seems to be like wave function collapsing. I like to say it, I have no idea what it means.
I looked it up and it had nothing to do with what I thought it did.
There's a guy on Twitter, Oscar Stahlberg, I hope I'm pronouncing right. He does these wonderful little games. I think, was it Dark North or something?
Yeah, that's
Bad,
right.
Bad North,
yeah.
And yeah, he does these amazing little things where he sort of generates these little buildings and islands and things. Absolutely wonderful. Such wonderful little toys. And makes really fun little games as well.
He does lovely explanations as well, which is kind of, I really like when people, instead of just saying, hey, look at my beautiful thing, it's like, here's how I shaped the world to my command by doing these three different things. let's get on. So we've been going on about procedural levels and PUBG, which could be called an open world level in a way. So the question is, any tips on how you would start an open world level, kind of Breath of the Wild, as it's a huge amount of work, but also hard to start? Well, here's what you do. You do a procedural terrain generation, procedural buildings, and you're done. That's it. Press publish. No, but sorry. This is a question by Jacob, by the way.
I think if I was starting something like that, the first thing I would do would be to break it down into smaller chunks, because I don't know how you'd do it otherwise. You know, Breath of the Wild's got its own individual sections. Yeah, I would imagine like you'd just start being like, okay, so maybe this is like an oceany area, and this is a mountain area, and this is a beach area, and then, you know, you can just break it down more and more and say, in a deserty place, what kind of environments am I going to have, what mechanics, what might I want. That would be my starting point anyway.
I think, no, like, yeah, breaking it down, like, there's no other way around it. Like, you have to understand, yeah, I think you have to understand your world for a start. So you have to, I guess, the stories are also going to come into this at the same time, at least the overarching story. So you're going to decide what type of world it is, etc. Like you said, coming up to different zones, and then you're just going to keep breaking it down. So it's like, right, I have these regions now, and then these regions turn into towns or cities, and then those have their own little micro, like organisms, and then that becomes the level design, right? So you... I guess you start designing locations, like small locations that, when put together, form a city or form a world.
There's a risk of just going completely mad. You have to, you know, build up to it, like the Jonathan has said.
There is a great talk by the guys that did Ghost Recon Wildlands, that because they went off to Bolivia, and that's kind of an open world, you know, it is an open world level, but what they were doing was trying to figure out, like, I don't want to sit there doing a spline path for a road, because that's how you're going to connect all these different encampments that might be manually crafted, I would say. Sounds kind of weird, but do you know what I mean? It's going to be very designed as areas, combat areas, with missions, with things that are very specifically placed rather than randomly placed. But then you have to have a whole road network and maybe a rail network. And now you've got this, let's say, a terrain generation. Then now you have to literally go and build miles and miles and miles of railway track that work, right?
Yeah, and with the fidelity that people demand in games nowadays, it's a massive amount of work to do something like that. So this is where, right. I'm sure you're going to say that the procedural stuff comes into its own. It's a system for making splines that cover the whole map, which do all the roads and all the railways and acts, you know, sort of create those procedurally rather than having to do them manually.
And it does the next level kind of stuff, like, say, for example, roads in Bolivia where Wildlands is set, kind of zigzag up on a hill. Like you can imagine also in San Francisco, there's that very famous road whose name I'm forgetting, Fremont Avenue. And they have a different terrain around them than you would have in a road that's not zigzagging up a hill. So, you know, and that's how you do all that procedural generation. So for doing the huge amount of work, you can cut out a lot of that by specializing, by working on your tools a little bit better. But as Claire says, you'd have to define the areas, right? You'd go, you have point A, point C, point B, the water, air, fire, whatever.
I guess you need to relate that back to like the progress of the player, and if it's truly like open world, then if they go in one direction versus another direction, what are they gonna find? Are they gonna find something that they can get through, or are they gonna sort of actually get to a point where they can't get past, and is that gonna be frustrating if they have to then go all the way back? So maybe even, I don't know, making, once you've got your map, kind of like a heat map of progress for it, so that you can see, okay, at this level or however that works in your game, the player can get to this region, and then maybe they can get a bit further out, so you can sort of start mapping out maybe the route that the player, or you know, the route that you would like the player to make, even though in theory they can go any way they like.
Well, I think it's like he mentions Breath of the Wild as like an example, and in Breath of the Wild obviously they use gating, they gate off regions using the climate. So based on the equipment you have kind of dictates where you can and can't go. So there's the obviously there's the heat side of it, and then there's the cold. If you haven't been to the village to get the right armor, which granted that village is usually quite close to it, but it will halt your progression. And I think they, like Claire mentioned, I think they did use heat mapping, or well, I think after it came out, they put up a heat map, and like you can see the majority of players went to the water thing first, and that's just because the progression naturally pushed over you that way, because you had no equipment at the start, and the other two zones required special equipment, so you had to find a way to get that stuff before you could go anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, and that's kind of the, not cheats, but that's like the hidden behind the scene things that you have to realize, that even though you think it's open world, and I know it's in the name, that there'll be areas that you can't go to by whatever gating mechanic the game has, right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, level design on a very, very large scale.
Right. I mean, it doesn't have to be. There was some Borderlands, for example, which is pretty open world. You can't teleport to certain areas unless you've gone to them first, and you can't go to some of them because you've got to beat a bad guy to get past an alleyway or something like that. That the bad guys. The big boss is doing, and you have to be a level 20 to beat him, right?
Yeah. You could physically bottleneck the environment if you want, but that tends to make the environment seem less open. So unless you do it in a really sensitive way, you're going to just put in great big mountain ranges with tiny tunnels through them, and it'll start looking not as open as you really want. Not like the first shot of Breath of the Wild when you walk up on the cliff and see the whole world and go, oh my God. You know, if that was all hidden behind five different mountains, it wouldn't be half as exciting.
I think it's like creating logical barriers. So like within your game world, so we mentioned Breath of the Wild uses climate, but it's like you can use logical barriers within your game world to explain why you can't go here yet. If it's a fantasy, maybe there's a war going on in this warring territory, so right now you can't get across there and stuff like that, so you're forced to go the other way until the war's over. And like, so like depending on the theme or the world or the strong sense you've got going, like you can define these scenarios or events that take place that prevent the player from going there for now.
With games that have come from Bethesda, like the Skyrim and Morrowind and Fallout, one thing that they take advantage of is they can have lots of map points which you hear about or decide to go to, and, you know, like a dungeon, basically.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look at it in the world, it's simply a door in a cliff or something.
Yeah,
that's all they really have to worry about, technically, is having space to put a door in. And then you go into there, and then you're in a new space where you do a whole lot of gameplay, which is a discrete chunk of game that someone can work on their own. You don't have to worry about it. But yeah, to go back to the top of the question, I guess it's, like exactly like Claire and Jonathan said, it's about going back to old school world design and saying, what is the story of the player? What is the story of the game? And where does it happen? And then getting a great big piece of paper and start drawing. And then gradually start filling it in more and more and more, and let it all come together to create a huge sort of tapestry of stuff. Because you can make the rules. So you've got to have a huge amount of freedom. I've just sort of chip away at that huge map, I'd say.
That's what Tolkien did, didn't he? Didn't he just draw a map and then went off from there, put some of the hobbits, and then went, right, they've got to walk from A to B. Talking about narrative, Guillaume asks, what is your advice on the construction of the narrative for an open world adventure game? I guess this is pretty similar to Breath of the Wild, right?
Yeah.
One tip that I got, which was from the Uncharted, The Lost Legacy, was that it feels very open world. It is, you know, you could say it's open world-ish, but it's also a narrative game. So narrative has got a sequence of things that you want to tell at certain points, right? And
I think
in open world, you can't.
Yeah, I think with Lost Legacy, as much as it has that illusion of open worldness, it's definitely much more of a sandbox, like sandbox environments.
Right.
They are open. There's multiple like avenues to choose. You see it in like Deus Ex's level design as well. Like the way you can approach an area is it's more of a sandbox and it is an open world. And Hitman is the same thing. It gives the illusion of being big, but it's the more it actually is. But you've just got one big sandbox location with multiple approaches.
Right, but I mean, in The Lost Legacy, what I was saying about the tricks that they're using are, for example, I think there is like five towers. I can't remember. It's been a while since I played it. And at each tower, they have a dialogue with each other that progresses the
narrative.
The narrative, right? And it doesn't matter in which order you do those towers, they have the same dialogue.
The conversation trees would pick up, right? So if you jumped out the jeep and went and did whatever you had to do at the tower, when you got back in, it would pick up from where it left off. So they would track.
Right. And even it didn't matter in which order you did the towers, you'd have the same outcome in a way, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so it doesn't it's not like they go to a different town and talk about something different. The narrative happens in that sequence as you unlock stuff.
Yeah.
But as you say, it's in a sandbox, so it's kind of
in that. I think once again, there was a GDC talk about like how they did this like conversation tree.
Can we just do like a link to GDC for this episode?
it's where we all do our research. It's like there's no point in denying it. But I remember them explaining the narrative system, and it was just tracking narrative threads. So it's like had this chain started yet? Yes, and then it was kind of like yes, no, it would return, and that's why you didn't get the repeated dialogue. And like you said, it didn't. It felt more open and natural because it didn't matter what order you did those towers in. The relationship between the two characters kind of like just developed, like regardless of how you played.
I guess even like around that, as well as having this sort of one main narrative that follows on.
Mm-hmm.
If you have localized sections of narrative that can kind of slot in anywhere but still tie into the main thread, and then you know you could even have, like, say you had a village and there's something going on there, you could even have maybe a few different things that would happen there, and then depending on when you go to that village, maybe if you've done the first arc of the story, then the second village event would happen, you know. So you don't really need to rely on too many branching things. It's like wherever you go, it's going to tie into the main narrative in some way.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's exactly. It's like you want to chunk up your missions and make them sort of discrete bits with a few little sort of global tendrils that come out of them, because you can't have everything in a massive web of interconnectedness. It's just not possible. You want to be able to say, okay, I've got to rescue this village from the bandits. So that is one thing. And then you've got a series of sort of sub objectives within that, or a series of conditions that are, you know, I've killed the bandit leader, I've killed five out of six bandits or whatever like that. And those are all, you can track those within that little chunk of narrative, and then out of that you've got one thing saying I defeated the bandits by doing this, or I defeated the bandits by doing that, and that can then link into all the other missions that you have going on, and you can slowly build up that kind of blobby web of this, you know, complex blobs that are linked by less complex little variables.
I think off the back, if you're tracking that stuff already is at the same time, you can almost have the world react to events you've done. So even going back to like Oblivion, if you closed the first Oblivion gate in Kvatch, you were now known throughout the entire of that game as the hero of Kvatch. But if you didn't go and do that gate, that dialogue option never like kind of showed up, wasn't strung out throughout the entire game like that, but it was kind of showed the idea. And it's just nice that, I guess, to have the world react to what some of the things, not everything the player does, but like Rob said, like specific chunks of a mission, or if you've done like a story arc, you're now known throughout the world for that. Because I think Infamous used its morality system to do that, and if you were good, like, people would cheer for you in the street. If you were bad, they would throw rocks at you.
Same as Dishonored, right? Like in Dishonored, like, well, not the same in Dishonored, but in Dishonored, that you'd have more rats, the more people you killed, the rats would appear, there would be more rats. But also you can give the illusion, I guess, of narrative. That's not quite it.
Yeah.
Shadow of War, for example.
The
orcs always remember, you know, oh, you killed me, I want to rip your arm off like you ripped my arm off. That sounds like a lot of work, but it's... Yeah.
It was a very good.
It's good flesh on the bones of the main narrative,
right? And it's adding a little spice to the main chunk of that. It's not actually adding anything to the main story, but it makes you think that there's more going on than.
Mm-hmm. To take the analogy further, the spine of your sort of huge your huge world body is something we touched on earlier. It is the player's story, or the story you want the player to experience. Their main objective, you know, it's to rescue Zelda, it's to rescue the wasteland, it's to do whatever. Do you want the thing that you want the player to hold in their mind all the time, going, this is what I'm trying to do, and these are the things that I'm going to wander off and try and accomplish. So they always have that kind of motivation. And then once you've got that spine, that is going to form the basis of all the things you can do. And then you can decorate that with lots of different little smaller and larger missions that, you know, you have a chain of main story missions that you must work out that every player has to do, and then you have multiple story missions that kind of cluster around those.
Those little ribs that stick out from them.
Exactly, yeah, something like that,
To follow the analogy to its horrible conclusion.
So yeah, we are, yeah, modern day Frankensteins.
Yeah, and you just stitch it all together.
Design monsters.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Well, I think that's it for this episode. We have lots more questions that we answer, and that's how we get you hooked onto like subscribing to our podcast. I'm presuming you're already subscribed, and it'd be great if you told your friends about it, dear listener. And don't just tell them, like grab their phone and just subscribe them to our podcast. I mean, if they like level design, if they are like an accountant and this is nothing, don't. You can get us, if you have any questions or comments, follow us on Twitter. It's a good place to be. There's Blocktober there. There's November. We're at Level Design FM, or you can send us any of your questions at show@leveldesign.fm. I am at Mark Drew. Rob, how can they get hold of you?
Find me on Twitter, RM McLaughlin. If you can spell McLaughlin, then you've won the prize.
Claire?
On Twitter, I am at ShimmerWitch.
And Jonathan?
At Omni/92.
And that's it. Thank you very much. And till the next time. Bye.
Bye. Thank you. Bye. Bye.